Hail and well met. Welcome back to another episode of Self-Evident. Today we're doing part two of our special series that's addressing the lies about gender and identity that have kind of swept across the West and are creeping into other corners of the world. So we have Maya and Camille back and a third person with us, or fourth, I guess, if you count me, Nick. So we're so glad to have you guys on. And I know we kind of heard your guys' stories at the beginning of the last one. But Nick, if you're cool with it, why did you decide to transition and kind of what led you to detransition?
The real like why is always still kind of a little up in the air, but I think combination of there being something genuinely very different about me. Well, there's just the nature nurture kind of thing about it. I really did have to actually give kind of a whole podcast one time to explain why, which I did on the Transparency podcast. But I don't know, basically I transitioned to try to make sense of what was really different about me and to resolve a sense of a lack of connection that I had with other people. I had a very hard time just connecting with, it felt like connecting with people on a really basic human level, even though I was a very like sensitive person who liked people. There was a lot of time growing up that I kind of told myself like, oh, I don't really need people. I was sort of one of those people that was kind of like my way of dealing with life. And I mean, I had friends, but I was very reclusive and kind of tended to stay on the outside of friend groups. And I just, kind of told myself, like, I don't really need other people. I tried at a really early age to be extremely independent, emotionally, intellectually, not to be influenced by other people, which is a blessing and a curse. Like I think our society in a way kind of idealizes sort of that sort of thing, like not being affected by other people's opinions. But eventually you do realize like you fundamentally need connection with other people and always develop your sense of self, your things that you like and the way that you see things based on your experience of community and the feedback that you get from other people. So it was that sort of tension of just kind of like not knowing where I stand that eventually I started to find that tied in with my feelings that my sexed body has like nothing to do with who I am as a person. I feel like I'm trying to say too much in a short amount of time, but I basically found that the idea that if I was female, I would be able to actually connect with people, that started to just make a lot of sense to me. If I was someone else, if people saw me totally differently, that must be what it would have taken for me to connect with other people. And there was a lot of self-hatred around everything male about me, everything masculine about me, more so than kind of like being embarrassed about anything feminine about me. And I think I'm a kind of have an androgynous sort of personality, but I always kind of liked the feminine aspects of myself as I saw it. A lot of stuff about why I transitioned to sort of resolve all of these tensions.
The way you said it makes sense, and I understood what you were saying. So, yeah.
I'm glad.
Don't have to worry about that. But what led you to then sort of detransition?
Yeah, I've been saying recently, like at the panel and on the Lost Boys documentary, it was really the experience of society actually accepting me as a trans woman, being fully willing to take me in and put me, categorize me in the sort of female role, that I found that it wasn't like other people resisting me that made me want to be trans. It was actually kind of socially beneficial for me in a way. People accepted me more. People seemed to like to be around me more. I felt, or at least I expected more that people would like to be around me. So I started to be less afraid socially, and I couldn't like blame it on other people that they weren't accepting me. It just really was like, I'm not a woman. I actually don't fit into this role. There is something really like deeply rooted in the fact that I was born male. All of my experience of being a person in a community has been filtered through being male. Everyone receives me as male. I always see myself as male, and I really can't change that. If I want to fully accept myself and fully flourish as a person, I have to really come to terms with my sex body. It's not irrelevant to my personality. It's thoroughly tied into my personality.
It is interesting too how we know we were created in a certain way. And when we try to go against the order in which we were created, things just don't work out, and we can tell, and there's something broken about it. But I know we heard a little bit about your guys' experiences on the previous episode of this, but I was wondering, would you mind giving just a really brief sort of recap for new listeners
Yeah, my name is Camille Kiefel, and I'm a detransitioner. I was struggling with childhood trauma. I sought transition as a form of escape. I was also dissociative, so I was disconnected from my body since I was 18. And then when I was 30, I transitioned because I had done about 20 years of traditional mental health therapy. Wasn't getting any reprieve from that. I had done two rounds of transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy, which is a treatment reserved for treatment-resistant depression. I didn't respond well to medications, so I was at the end of my rope. They transitioned me to a non-binary sex, which doesn't exist in nature, which is surreal. And then after the surgery, the top surgery, I ended up developing complications. My doctors took me seriously at first until they thought I had psychosomatic fever, and then their attitude changed quite a bit. And I remember I was trying everything. Like, they told me to take sertraline. I came in one day, I'm like, I have these bumps on my arms. I think I have a rash. And he's like, yes, I do think you have a systemic rash, but I need you to continue taking the medication. I received very poor care afterwards, even though I hadn't detransitioned at that point. I know many detransitioners, they detransition and then they receive poor care, but I know what it's like when you're struggling with severe mental illness and doctors treat you very poorly. My doctor got frustrated. It's interesting looking at the doctor's note because you can tell he was frustrated that I wasn't seeing a therapist, but I'd done 20 years of it. So I knew that wasn't the answer. And so at that point, I took my health into my own hands because my doctors were not helping me at all. I saw Michaela Peterson and she was on a carnivore diet. And I was like, wow, she seems really emotionally stable. And so I was a pescatarian. Only for me, I was getting was fish for over a decade. And I decided to add meat back into my diet. And I started feeling better. I started recovering. And then I did body work and manual therapy. And I started getting better. I also was a part of a hyperbaric oxygen therapy case study. I did 60 treatments. And I was documenting daily what my improvements are. My ADHD went from 72 points to 6. And then my generalized anxiety disorder went away.
That's insane. And I know, yeah. So you recorded a podcast with us that we released last week and it was really good. I listened to it. And one thing you said on that was that a lot of your mental health struggles went away when you started taking care of your physical body. And I thought that was just incredibly interesting because one thing that I think studies have shown and that we've seen and heard in some of the experiences you guys have shared is that a lot of struggles with how you're feeling gender-wise relate to some mental health struggles. It's just neat to see how that quote, I think, just it encapsulates a lot about how to feel better.
But yeah, it's so concerning because of the fact that, like, I'm president of Detrans Health, which is a nonprofit by detransitioners for detransitioners. And we had a young man reach out to us and he's overweight. And he's struggling with suicidal ideation. He wants to opt out of gender and he wants nothing to do with sex. And the first thing the doctors are recommending to him is for him to transition. And I'm like, there's nothing about this that sounds trans. Like, it's not even like I knew I was trans since I was 5 years old. Like, I knew I was a girl. It was, I want to opt out. Like, I want nothing to do with this. It's concerning because in our medical system, there's such a lack of looking at underlying health issues that can be leading to a degradation in mental health. And so I'm very worried about that because a lot of the discussion has been, well, they just need to see more therapists, another therapist, another therapist. And I'm like, I did 20 years of that. Like, there are certain people, they're going to need to address their physical health. You're never going to get to the root cause of the problem if you just keep addressing, like, just seeing another therapist. If the root cause is something like inflammation or, you know, something like that.
And did you notice a change at all in your mental health when you did transition? Or was it just kind of the same and it didn't help as much as you thought it would?
The thing was, I didn't even get a time to really register, like, what had happened. Like, I thought this was the right thing after I transitioned. Days after the surgery, I got scopolamine poisoning, so my left eye was dilated, and then I had trouble swallowing, and then I developed Raynaud's, and this is within days of the surgery. So, like, dilation was day one, and then it's just, all these other things compounded afterwards, like tinnitus, bony prominences, Raynaud's, skin discoloration, all these things happened after the surgery. I think it was just such a stressful event on my body that I didn't even have time to register what had happened. So
That does make sense. What about you? How did you experience after you decided to transition or detransition? Did you notice any mental health changes, or did it really not help, or did it just stay the same? Or how did that kind of affect it?
So for people who didn't listen to the first part of this podcast, my name is Maya Poet. I'm 24 years old. I started identifying as trans when I was 12 in 2012. So I was an early adopter of this fantasy, this ideology, this dream, whatever you want to call it, this delusion. I went so far as to move to the Middle East in order to transition away from my non-affirming parents. And I lived undercover as a man for 4 years within both Palestinian Muslim communities and religious Jewish communities. And it was really the experience of living through war that snapped me out of it. Just realizing how impractical it is to be tied to pharmaceutical industries, undergo elective surgeries that can have extensive complication rates, and never being able to predict whether or not I would be able to access the care to overcome those issues if need be, to save my life at the last minute, as often happens with a lot of women who take testosterone, like that it harms their reproductive system, sometimes to such an extent that the reproductive atrophy and the genital atrophy can go septic. There have been cases of that, and the entire reproductive system needs to be removed in order to save the individual's life. And this would be a perfect example of iatrogenic harm, so harm being done in the process of treatment. And so I managed somehow to never medically transition. That was the goal the entire time. But a few things really stopped that from happening. One of them is that in order to move to Israel and access these treatments, I needed to become a citizen so that I could become a member of the national healthcare system. And the bureaucracy didn't handle my case very swiftly. It took 3 years of being transferred between 5 different agencies who kept saying, you know, you're not our problem, you're somebody else's problem. And so I was illegal for several years. And so I didn't have a worker's visa. So I worked for cash jobs. I did like cleaning and catering within the Orthodox Jewish sector of the society. You know, I wore the whole getup. I wore the yarmulke, the black pants, white shirt. Basically, I was just cosplaying as an Orthodox Jewish guy. It was actually a pretty interesting experience. Like, I can say with certainty that very few women have experienced what it's like to be an Orthodox Jewish man. So I didn't medically transition. But what I will say is that even just the social transition and the amount of interventions that you need to undertake in order to keep up the lie of a social transition that isn't medicalized is pretty astounding. Like, the most probably pertinent one of these would be binding. So binders are basically these really tight compression garments that women, and also men with gynecomastia, but mostly in this case, we're talking about women who have normal healthy breast tissue, who will squash it down with this compression garment in order for their chest to appear more masculinized. Any of these companies that sell binders will tell you that, you know, you should wear it maximum 8 hours a day. From the moment that you start binding, at least in my case, it was addictive. Binding is like a sweet poison. You know, there's a reason why in the early 2000s, for example, antifreeze was made to have a bitter taste, because previously it had a sweet taste. And so it was very easy for people to poison other people by putting antifreeze in a sweet drink. And I compare binding much to that, because of course I had discomfort around my breasts. I mean, from the age of 12, I mean, basically every girl has problems, you know, with her developing body. It's an awkward time. I hit puberty really young. And rather than overcoming that, like, distress with time and with experience in the way that most people have to overcome distress, instead, I basically just put all of my distress at that time in a time capsule, locked it away, and didn't have to encounter it until, of course, I had made the decision to detransition because of the fact that I basically thought, I don't need to overcome, you know, the discomfort I have around my breasts, because someday I'll remove them. And so, you know, I built my entire sense of self on a set of false premises, on a bunch of lies, most fundamental of which is that because I like to wear, you know, vests and bow ties and the more fashionable end, you know, end of the men's section, and that because I love women, that means that somehow my female body is wrong, and that my healthy female body existing in its natural state is existing in a state of pathology, and that this, you know, pathology of being female is something that I ought to rectify with experimental and dangerous interventions that I can do as soon soon as I'm like financially independent of my parents, like that's the way that I viewed my entire situation. I saw like, you know, my highly analytical nature, the same sex attraction, and just a bunch of other things about myself as being more evidence for the fact that I should have been born male. The interventions that I undertook to align this, you know, unprovable gendered soul with my body were definitely astounding. The binding, because I was living as a guy and because it would have been dangerous for the people around me to figure out the truth that what I actually was just a lesbian, and, you know, meaning a woman, especially a masculine woman. People in traditional cultures don't react very fondly to that fact. In Israel, I was a peace activist. I did a lot of work with Arabs and Jews, and I would do peace events in Bedouin villages. And Bedouins are nomadic Arabs who have kind of encampments, and they travel from one to the other. So I had to sleep in the binder in order to maintain the illusion that what I actually was a man. And that's extremely dangerous because you're not just compressing your breast tissue, which already has like glands in it that need to not be compressed, but like it also compresses your ribs. Like my breathing patterns have changed totally just from binding for, wow, like 7 years, from, you know, squashing my chest for 7 years. Fundamentally, people act like social transition is harmless, but that's not true. It's actually a very powerful psychosocial intervention that you do sometimes, even before you intervene with like hormones and surgeries, using binding or tucking. These are interventions that harm the natural movement of your body, whether it's your breasts or your genitals. Fundamentally, I never had to, like, because I was like squashing my chest for so many years, I didn't ever like include my breasts in the psychological mapping of my own body. So of course, it made it much easier to think, oh, I can just get rid of this because I didn't have to look at it all day. Like, and all of this distress that I was like dealing with ever since I was 12, I'm now having to deal with it as someone, you know, in her early to mid 20s, instead of having to deal with it as a 12 and 13 year old. And so I would say that that is probably the most harmful aspect of this entire ideology, especially when you get into it so young and you intertwine your sense of, you're developing your burgeoning sense of self with a bunch of false premises and lies. It becomes psychologically catastrophic. And that happens even before you intervene hormonally or surgically.
Would you say that you were influenced at all to kind of thinking that, oh, becoming a guy will make me feel better? Was there anything that brought that idea to you or influenced you in that direction, like social media or entertainment or people? Or
yeah, so I would say that people influenced me, but probably not in the way you're thinking. For me, what it really came down to is that I started to, you know, experience crushes on girls, and I didn't know what crushes were because I come from a very intellectual family and we don't talk about emotions. So I thought the crush was an orange soda. I thought my peers were obsessed with the orange soda crush. I didn't realize that what they were referring to were romantic feelings. When I started to experience romantic feelings, that really showed up as just a bunch of different sensations in my body, like, you know, skyrocketing heart rate, dry mouth, just being incoherent around the target of my attractions, which were girls in my class, and really just becoming a total mess, going from like a mini professor to an incoherent mess around girls I liked. And I didn't know what that was. So I went on the internet and I went on WebMD and I typed in my symptoms, and the results showed that I had any of three possible neurodegenerative diseases that all had like, you know, fatal outcomes.
Because Google is always helpful.
Right, exactly. And at the same time, like I was developing my sense of style, and I really, for some reason, was just drawn to vests and bow ties, like not even average men's clothing. Like men don't really wear that type of stuff these days. I'm kind of a quirky person and I have an interesting sense of style. But the message I got from adults in my life was that, you know, women who dress in men's clothing, even like very, and have like these very types of, you know, extremely quirky styles, that is disgusting. That is unsightly to look at. At that moment, I had seen around me older men who were doing what was called sex changes. Like that was a concept I was aware of, even as early as 2008, 2009, when I was like 8, 9 years old. I'd heard about it on the radio. I grew up in a progressive city, so I saw it. You know, I didn't know whether it was possible for women to do these sex changes as well. And I actively sought it out on the internet because I was like a little medical researcher as a kid. I mean, I read medical journals and parenting books for fun, you know, starting at the age of 8 and 9. So I'm very research oriented. And for me, it was really the, you know, the influences in my environment that made me feel so much shame for wanting to wear like vests and bow ties and have like snazzy short haircuts. The shame that people made me feel around the fact that I was gay, that being a lesbian is like the last possible resort for me, that I need to do everything in my power to not become that. But rather than trying to mask the same sex attraction, because that's what a lot of people would do in my situation, but because I'm an oddball, I didn't do that. And instead, what I thought was, I'm just going to become a man, and then I don't have to deal with any of this flack from society. I can just improve my own life and make my own life easier and create a reality in which I can walk down the street with a beautiful woman someday in the future and not have people, you know, give me odd looks and not have, you know, the people who are closest to me disparage me over this fact. Like, for me, it was really escaping the shame around all of those things and trying to find the most sort of rational way out. And unfortunately, I came to that conclusion when I was 12, before I had ever experienced, you know, a loving relationship, anything of that nature, which is why a lot of kids who are likely to grow up to be gay, who get into this, you know, people like Jazz Jennings, right? Like these feminine little boys. The reason why a lot of these kids who struggle with gender dysphoria pre-puberty desist, something like 60 to 90% of them, is because puberty solves their issue specifically in the way that they have a sexual awakening. They realize whether they're, you know, straight, gay, or bisexual, and they kind of understand themselves a little bit better. And then instead of attributing their nonconformity, you know, to having like a female or male soul inside of an opposite sex body, they attribute it to what's actually going on with them with a more adult outlook on
it. So it kind of becomes a way to reconcile, figure out how they're feeling, trying to avoid some of those negative feelings.
To rationalize.
What about you guys? So how have you seen influences? What led you to think that, okay, yes, this must be my option? And I know you were talking about therapy, but was there anything else, or the lack of therapy helping, I guess?
Yeah, I wasn't really part of some of these sort of trans groups that were really affirmation feedback kind of loop sort of thing that a lot of people have been pulled in either. It was around like 2010, 2011 that I first started thinking that having been born female would have resolved all of my social problems. I mean, I was a part of like the Gay Straight Alliance then, and then I went into Pride Group in college, and I wasn't like really close knit with those groups, but I do think back then, even 2010, a lot of the things that they were talking about in the GSA were kind of like very pre-woke, like before that really became mainstream, they already had like a lot of those kinds of talking points that I guess kind of got in my head. I didn't really like the politics. I didn't really like the sort of the pushiness about it, and a lot of the speech censoring, kind of like a lot of that stuff was going
on. This might be slightly unrelated, but it did make me think of this. Are you guys going to consider trans policy of the different candidates when you vote? What their policy is surrounding transgender and LGBTQ and all of that stuff?
I certainly would take it into account.
Yeah, I do.
Whatever election, whether I vote in an Israeli election or an American election, I definitely would.
Sorry, that was just a rabbit trail, but it made me think of it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think much like too non-political. Like, I think a lot of people say like, oh, I'm not into politics, but everyone is political. It's just a part of being human. But I you know, again, that was part of my like being detached from people. But I still, like, just on a very personal level, I wasn't into the like the trans politics. But the whole idea that I have this identity that like has nothing to do with my social role and has nothing to do with my body, that was very appealing to me because of the whole wanting to be like totally authentically me. And that my desires and my perception is just entirely the source of my identity. Nothing from the outside determines my identity. But I think that that's kind of just really basic to how our society has been thinking more and more over the last several decades, century.
Very individualistic and self-focused sort of type of thing.
A kind of a conceptual identity. But I think that all of that kind of individualism is always completely pretentious. Like, nobody actually is that type of an individual. Nobody is actually that independent. People just kind of pretend that they are, but you actually live in a society that wants you to be that way. You do that for social approval. Like, it's really, really socially embarrassing to look like you're doing things because of other people, but everybody does that. Looking back on it, I realized that a lot of what I was doing was a lot of the self-hatred that I had around being male, and a lot of the messages that I picked up, which were usually kind of like under the surface, but were persistent, where men are dangerous, men are the sources of the problems of the world, and men should always kind of have like a little bit of shame in everything that they do and think in a certain like deference. That kind of stuff really, really stuck with me. And so I realized like if I transition, like people aren't going to be having the same kinds of suspicions and sort of wariness and sort of, you know, they're going to be happier to hear me, give my opinions, or they're going to be happier to like have me around. And people did. I mean, it did feel like people were a lot gentler.
Where do you guys think culture gets its lies about gender from?
It's a good question. So it's a very complicated question. It's interesting because I think there's a shift in media becoming more leftist. Like I grew up in the 90s. The tomboy became more of a popular thing. There's especially like if you're a little bit different, you're watching. There's a couple different videos. There's like Evanescence, there's Pink. And I remember particularly in the Evanescence video, there's like a music video and there's like, it's like the housewife is fake and stuff like that. And then the feminine girls are like bimbos and like, you know, sexual. And it's just sort of, but she's also like destructive as well. And so it's just like, there's nothing good coming out of that video. Like there's a lot of self-destruction. It's kind of interesting how these messages came in. I want to say that they came from the left. It's interesting. I'm like, where exactly did this come from? But I remember getting those messages and it seems to kind of have gone further. And it maybe some of it is escapism, like why can't I be feminine or why am I not feminine enough? I know like for me, I've felt that way. Like I was like told like, okay, don't tell boys you like comics and stuff. And my experience is that you tell boys you like comics and they actually like that. So it's like, they want to have that discussion because like, oh, you have a similar interest. And, but yeah, there's kind of this weird, almost like self-loathing. And it's like the, kind of the idea of privilege and all that, that came out of critical theory, you know, cis white privilege, straight, you know, it's this negative thing. And then two, like the really, the poor morale in America and stuff. Like, I think all of it's really connected. But yeah, it is really interesting because I noticed it seemed to start in the 90s and then it just has seemed to gotten worse and like almost like taken on a new form.
So I think that like if we're referring to gender lies as like the modern iteration of the transgender movement and gender ideology. So I think that when we reduce it to its fundamental core, it's really like societies throughout time have had to figure out like how to rationalize nonconformity. I mean, people are inherently tribal creatures. As much as we don't like to think of ourselves as tribal creatures, we're always establishing, you know, in and out groups, drawing the boundaries around who's a member of the in-group, what is acceptable deviation versus unacceptable deviation. You know, this is the principle behind why there are things like religious schisms, why there are why there are cultural disputes and tribal disputes. And fundamentally, this transgender phenomenon, I think we can really trace it back to the Netherlands. I mean, all of these treatments were pioneered in the Netherlands, and it was actually done under a Christian philosophy, done in a Christian hospital. And the philosophy, the way in which they interpreted Christianity in order to justify these treatments is that, you know, because Christianity believes in the soul, these doctors basically combined religion and science in a really peculiar way that hadn't really been done before, to my knowledge, which was just, they basically accepted that people have this, their soul is right? They have a female soul or a male soul, opposite sex body, and that if the soul is causing the patient to suffer to such an extent, well, you can't change the soul. So what do? You change the body. Like religion in general, there's this kind of this, I think what these doctors were doing was basically making an entire theory upon which they, you know, used to justify these treatments. And the theory was premised upon the idea that there's something wrong with the carnal desires and the flesh in and of itself, and that the soul is pure and the soul needs to be elevated. So
that was interesting to me, because it sounds like they took, because biblical doctrine does talk about there being something fundamentally wrong with all of us, but it doesn't lift the soul up as being pure, because we understand that the world's broken. There's sin everywhere. There's fallenness. There's wrong things. We can't do anything to make that better. We rely totally on the sacrifice of God's Son, who came and took that on himself to die and then come back and take that off of us. And so it's interesting because it sounds like those doctors didn't necessarily understand scripture or what the Bible was saying. Or
yeah, I mean, they had a certain philosophy. They weren't theologians. Within every religion, there are people who believe different things. And like that's the beauty of pluralism. I mean, people can take the same document and interpret it a ton of different ways. And who is to really say whose interpretation is the most accurate, right? You just have a bunch of opinions. And if you want your opinion to be the predominant opinion, you have to convince other people of the fact that your opinion is the predominant opinion. And these doctors, that's what they did. All of their studies were based off of extremely flawed methodology. Like if you read, you know, the original Dutch studies and the Dutch protocol, I mean, it was just really shoddy science. And the way I see all of this gender medicine is that it's just shoddy science that is being done upon a list of assumptions, a bunch of assumptions about what gender dysphoria is, and not taking into account all of the different subgroups of people who are afflicted with this condition, including the new cohorts of like teenage girls who didn't used to be present. What I think we're seeing with like how these gender lies spread is that you have like the queer theory, right? Like what Camille was talking about. You have different ways of like rationalizing the world and different philosophies. And that's not inherently harmful. Like, yeah, there are bad ideas, but not all bad ideas are harmful, even though the woke brigade might like to convince us while peddling their own wrong ideas, of course. But that's not necessarily true. What makes this dangerous, however, is that this philosophy is being pushed not only as a philosophy, but as a sort of guidebook with medical interventions that don't have any evidence base underpinning them, where it's totally reliant on like qualitative self-report about regret or no regret, where there's really like horrible patient follow-up because people who are harmed by these gender doctors don't go back to their doctors. Why would they go back to their doctors? They're lost by the system. Nobody follows up with them. What I really hope happens when we take down the scandal of gender medicine that is like infiltrated really every single Western institution is that as a society, we redefine our notion of in and out groups and like acceptable versus unacceptable deviance. Like I hope that our society grows to accept harmless nonconformity instead of endlessly pathologizing it.
That's interesting. And I don't know if you've heard of Ali Beth Stuckey, but she was also talking about the origins of some of this transgender theory. And she was talking about, I haven't heard the thing about it, the Netherlands, but she was talking about it starting in college professor who I think was from the US and did some really, really horrible experiments on
John Money. Kids.
Yes, him. And that's kind of how it got started in the US. But a lot of really sketchy, awful, just horrible stuff that goes on in the way some of the science about it was done. And it's really awful. But thank you guys so much for coming on. We appreciate what you have to say. So, and now without further ado, let us firmly rely on the protection of divine providence. And this is Self-Evident.